Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
They say third time's the charm, but for Christians in California, as it turns out, the fifth time is the charm. The Golden State has lifted all of its capacity limits on in-person gatherings at houses of worship following a fifth straight loss at the U.S. Supreme Court. Those words in a column at Focus on the Family's Daily Citizen recently by staff writer Zachary Mettler. And the point being that the nation's churches have, it seems to many of us, been the subjects of a very thinly veiled war of discrimination. Focus on the Family's legal analyst Bruce Hauskonecht has been following this court case, as well as other discussions related to our first freedom, the First Amendment, during the pandemic. And Bruce, I look forward to talking with you because you have some deep concerns about the trends, not just for California, but the rest of the country, right?
I do. It's good to be with you today, Don.
Great to have you with us, as always. While the discriminatory treatment of churches in California and not only at the governor's level, but even county officials and others, it seems to me some of the most egregious cases come out of California. But it's by no means limited to the West Coast, is it? It's really almost systemic in some ways in other parts of the country. Am I right?
It's true. You know, who would have believed a year ago when we started into this COVID-19 lockdown that the biggest testing point in the law that we'd experience over the next 12 months was freedom of religion? I mean, think about some of the states where governors and city mayors simply ordered churches closed because they could. They didn't even really distinguish churches from any other type of activity. In fact, how many of them declared religion non-essential, and which justified completely closing churches to indoor worship? We've experienced that, and California has been probably the biggest offender since then. But events throughout the year have really not only shown an improvement in the way the courts have ruled over it, but it also serves as a warning for how fragile our religious freedom really is, dealing as it does with just one extra appointment to the Supreme Court when Amy Coney Barrett joined in October.
And as has been noted, the critics are saying, oh, you're just weaponizing the First Amendment. That's become a catchphrase lately, weaponizing things. But how do you answer and respond to that accusation on the part of those of us who are complaining about this infringement of our freedoms, those on the other side saying, oh, you're just weaponizing the First Amendment?
Yeah, I think we've come to an era where secularism is so dominant that there are legitimately a majority of people in this country who view religion as an impediment to our progress, quote unquote, as a country. And they would like nothing better than to see religion ratcheted down and believers told they can believe what they want in the four corners of their own house and maybe within the four corners of their church. But pretty much they want to determine that it's a second-class right. It has nothing to do with being our first freedom anymore. That's the kind of attitude in society that we're dealing with, and is the root cause for all of these excessive attempts at government regulation of our freedom to worship.
And why do you suspect, or why would you say, the early fathers, the founding fathers, saw that first freedom as just that, the first freedom out of which other freedoms would flow, assuming and understanding that not all of them were devout believers themselves?
I think they recognized that the freedom to ponder the creation of the universe, ponder where we come from, to reach conclusions in our hearts about what we believe as to eternal life and as to an infinite God, forms the basis for all other thought. or all other freedom of thought. If you're not free to believe and act on those beliefs in eternity, then pretty soon you won't be free to talk about other issues in the public square. And those rights that we enjoy today, with freedom of association and freedom of speech, freedom of petition, and the freedom of assembly, those all flow downhill from the freedom of worship upon which this country was founded. And I think that's what the founders recognized, even if they weren't all completely devout Christians.
Where has this come from, Bruce? In other words, this has not come about in a vacuum. What are the seeds of this? And as far as you can ascertain, where have they started and brought us to this moment?
Well, there probably ebbs and flows throughout history. But in modern history, I think the U.S. has experienced this going back to the 60s and the sexual revolution. I think the emphasis on me, myself, and I, my sexual needs, first it fueled the abortion industry, then it fueled the same-sex marriage protection movement. And in between, we started to raise ourselves as God, not submit to the one true God. And I view that sort of as the precursor to the situation that we find ourselves in 2021.
And isn't it interesting, in just those two areas that you talked about, sexual relationships that were challenged and so flaunted in the 60s, now we are being forced to accept any aberration that anybody chooses may be their proclivity or their preference.
It's very true, and we're seeing it not only in their sexual preference, but with this major effort in gender identity to completely redefine what it is to be a male or a female. It's incredible the depths to which we have plunged in terms of theology in order to make people feel good about themselves. So we're in a downward trend in terms of that cultural impetus that started in the 60s.
Now, at the outset of our visit, we talked briefly about the fact that this is the fifth time California has gotten the no vote at the highest level of our courts. One can only wonder what things would look like if, in fact, the Biden administration et al. Ends up being able to pack the courts. Explain for folks, and I'm sure most folks know what that means, but explain the idea of packing the courts and why that is such a dangerous and destructive idea to our republic.
Yes. Packing the courts simply means adding to the number of justices. There are currently 9, which was set by Congress way back in 1869 after it had fluctuated several times since the founding. But it's been at 9 since 1869. It's simply by passing a law, which means that the current president would then have the ability to nominate and appoint 4 more justices. And since there seems to be a 6-3 conservative majority on the court right now, adding four more justices from a liberal president would conveniently flip the court from 6-3 conservative to 7-6 liberal. And at which point, you could achieve anything you wanted policy-wise just by taking it to the Supreme Court and asking them to legislate from the bench, which has been a terrible feature of our Supreme Court, you know, since the days of the Warren Court in the 60s. So, yes, we do not like anyone tinkering with the number of justices on the Supreme Court for the purposes of achieving a political result at the court.
And another thing, while I have you, that's under challenge and has been for years, but increasingly, is the whole idea of totally doing away with the Electoral College and heading into new elections. There are still those now more than ever pushing to eliminate that. Explain why that would be a disaster as well.
Yeah, the whole Electoral College creation of the founders was designed to make sure that smaller states, in terms of population, did not get run over at election time by large states. By apportioning votes in the Electoral College based on the number of senators plus the number of representatives you have in Congress. It evened out some of the disparities between large states with large populations like New York and California with smaller states like North Dakota and Rhode Island, for instance. So because of recent elections where the president is chosen, of course, by the Electoral College, but the president did not get the popular vote, but won the Electoral College vote, people on the left have used that to argue that the Electoral College is a failure. I would argue just the opposite, that it proves the wisdom of the founders that we need to balance the interests of the states against each other and not simply let the number of votes in the country for a president determine the outcome, because that will put the presidential election in the hands of the larger states, and the smaller states will never even see a campaigning of candidates for president. They'll just be ignored, glossed over, and the whole system will completely change. We don't want to see that.
Well, to circle back to our original topic, Bruce, talk to us as pastors, as individual citizens, as church groups. How can we undergird and strengthen this fragile freedom of religion that you and I have just briefly talked about? What can we do now to help reinforce that or protect that?
Yes, there are two ways, one spiritual, one natural. The spiritual, of course, we need to pray for the judges at every level of state and federal government, but especially for the justices on the Supreme Court. They grapple with the hardest cases in the country, and much is riding on their activities that lead them to make the decisions in one case or another. So pray for them every day. In the natural, we have responsibilities as citizens to vote. We have to realize that, and maybe we all do, we realize that when we vote, like for a president, that president gets to nominate and appoint justices to the Supreme Court, nominate and appoint justices to the 900 plus or minus seats in the federal court system. That's a lot of judges who have important decision-making abilities that are going to influence the country for years and decades to come. So we can't take those responsibilities to vote lightly. We have to walk into the voting booth every time, mindful that who we vote for has downstream effects, and we need to just take that seriously.
Good words. Thank you, my friend. I always look forward to talking with you.
Same here. You have a great rest of your day.
All right. Bruce Hoskonecht, he is the attorney and judicial analyst for Focus on the Family, examining just some of the things we're talking about, tracking with him on a regular basis. And you can check his work and that of the colleagues, his colleagues out at focusonthefamily.com.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.